Welcome to another study in the Word of God with pastor and teacher Rick Boya. The birth of Samuel marks the beginning of a new era in Israel's history. As a prophet and judge, Samuel anointed Saul, who was their first king, but also established the ministry of prophets, which served within and without their established priesthood. Though the reign of King Saul was in so many ways a failure, he was the first to embody the messianic role of king, priest, and prophet. For us today, 1 Samuel is a reminder that while human governments exist, God is still the one who rules the nations. Here now with a study in 1 Samuel is Pastor Rick.
Good evening, everybody. Let's get into the Word together. We'll be in 1 Samuel chapter 27. 1 Samuel 27. The older you get, the bigger your life is, usually. Life is sort of simple, it seems, when you're young, because life is fairly small. Other people are making huge numbers of decisions around you, and you have the great luxury of simply complaining about them. Truly. I mean, you know, and it is a luxury. It's a huge luxury to simply say, well, if I were in charge, it would be different. And then eventually, if you live long enough, you end up being in charge of something. And you realize, this isn't as fun as it looked when I was complaining about the people who were in charge. That's because life gets big and it gets complex. The more complex your life is, the bigger it is, the more responsibilities you have, the tougher the decisions are. It seems decisions come in precisely the sizes that we need in order to challenge us, in order to force us to trust God. If you thought every once in a while back to, say, turn the clock back a few years and say to yourself, you know, if I could only be handling the problems I was handling back then, now I know just what I would do with all of those problems. Problem was, I didn't know how to handle them then, and so I was really on my knees a lot about it. But if the Lord could just shrink the size of my problems that I got going now to the size of the ones I had sometime previously in my life, I'd know just what to do. But then we look at the ones we got going now, and they're humongous. But remind yourself that there will come a day when you look back on these as well. And you'll say, oh, I know just what I would have done about that now. And someday we'll be with the Lord, and we will look back on everything that happened here with that precise point in mind. When we are challenged to trust God for guidance, it is always a challenge suitable to the size of our life, suitable to our station in life. And the Lord says, I have designed, in essence, the challenges and all of the troubles and all the crises and all the joys to exactly who you are. For the purpose not simply of making it easy for life to happen, but for the purpose of forcing out of you, out of me, where we really are with Him. It's not about solving problems. It's simply about responding in faith to whatever happens to be going on, really learning how to trust Him in the situation. Now, when the decisions are very tough and life is very big, very often we pour our heart out to the Lord and wonder if we've done the right thing. If you've been around for a while, you know that feeling. Maybe there's a decision that you're making right now, and you're wondering, if the decision has been made already, was it the right decision? Will the Lord honor my decision? Or maybe there's something facing you and you're saying, Lord, I just have to do the right thing here. I have to do the right thing, and I'm really not exactly sure what it will be. But I'm going to do the very best I can to walk with you. Interestingly, as we look into these two chapters of 1 Samuel, we find David and Saul facing the worst challenges of their lives to date. All of the challenges up to this time in both of their lives are small by comparison to the way they feel as we look into this particular point in the history, in the story. The year is one of the times when we are pretty sure we know the year that something takes place. Usually we got to give or take 5 or 10 years when you're dating things and events in the Old Testament and the New Testament. But here, this is almost certainly about 1012 B.C., about the year 1012 B.C. David's life, by the way, if you ever wonder about timelines, David's life as king, always think of it as 1000 B.C., just round it off to 1000 before Christ. What takes place here in 1010 B.C. is the greatest challenge to face Saul and David. And each one, of course, they are estranged from one another. They were at one time very good friends, father-in-law and son-in-law and all those nice things, and now they are estranged from one another. They haven't seen each other for quite some time, and actually Saul's been trying to kill David for the last 8 to 10 years. And David's been running around in the wilderness trying to avoid being killed, and he's running around with some 600 men and their families, totaling over 1,000 people that he's responsible for. So at this particular time, both of these men have large lives. Saul is the king of Israel, and he's been losing control for some time, and it's panicking him. He's completely panicked by it. And we'll see what happens in his life when he really faces trial, very different than what happens in David's life when he faces trial. Nevertheless, both of them have to face a major trial, a life-threatening situation. And for David's part, he's not like Saul. He hasn't lost it all. What he's acquired is a huge amount of responsibility, over 1,000 men, women, and children, relying on him for guidance and direction. And they all know that most of the armies of Israel would go out and find David and kill him if they could. So these people are hiding, running for their lives. And David feels very, very responsible about this. He feels like he needs to do something. What he does is going to surprise us. Saul, for his part, is facing a war with the Philistines. And the Philistines have a great many mercenaries and a great many extra warriors that they bring into the field of battle, and it ends up frightening Saul to death. He has a whole nation that he wants to protect, but most of all in Saul's heart and mind is his own reputation. And by the way, if you have to carry a big reputation, my heart goes out to you. Because it's really tough. If you think you're something really, really important, it's very, very tough to keep that up. And that's what Saul has to face. David, fortunately, is free of ego for the most part, but he has a huge amount of responsibility. Both these men facing terrible, terrible decisions ahead. Also, something else you need to know, their trials are going to come to an end in different ways, but their trials are going to come to an end within the next 16 months, and neither of them know it. This has been going on, this fight between Saul and David has been going on for 8 to 10 years, and David is beginning to think this could go on for who knows how long. The Lord did not give him a blueprint. They did not know that this was going to be over within the next 16 months. And especially this is important for David and for us to view David this way. If you were to view David's trial here, running from Saul on a graph, this would be the last inch of it, the last inch of the trial, the last fairly short period of time of this long period of trial. But David doesn't know that. He thinks the thing could go on forever. And he makes some decisions, again, that will surprise us because of the amount of weight that's on him. And you may debate, and we will a little bit, debate about the wisdom of some of the decisions he makes as he faces these heavy-duty things. Saul, as well, does not realize how close his end really is. And even right up until the very end, he does not change his character, which is very, very sad. By the way, back to David again. You never know how long your trial is going to last. And oftentimes, we make a decision that might, we could look back on it later and say, you know, I'm sorry I made that decision. I thought the trial was going to go on forever. And I made a kind of a decision without talking to the Lord about it, without taking godly counsel, because I thought it would fix things. And then as it all turned out, if I'd have just waited a little longer and trusted God a little more, it would have been okay. That happens a lot. David faces a decision very much like that. What happens, I'll tell you ahead of time, is that as both of these men are pressed by their circumstances, David becomes a Philistine mercenary. And you've got to understand what a shock that is to everybody who heard about it. If you know the David story, you already know what's going to happen. But for David, the king-elect of Israel, to become a Philistine mercenary would be like General MacArthur becoming a Nazi, okay? I mean, it just doesn't make sense. And people would be completely shocked. But that's what David at least appears to do. And he thinks it's going to be the only way. It's a little bit of deception he sets up. He thinks the only way is going to solve his problem. And Saul, if David becomes a mercenary, Saul actually rings up the psychic hotline to find out something. Now, that's a bizarre thing for a king of Israel. Hello? So here you have the king-elect working for the Philistines. And here you have the king on the throne calling the psychic hotline to find out what the future holds. What a completely bizarre view of the people of God, of Israel. I mean, you know, just looking at this account, you would think to yourself, the Lord hasn't got anything to do with any of this. Everybody, I mean, just if you just watch the news, which gives no spiritual interpretation of anything. I agree. If it gives no spiritual interpretation of anything, and you would think to yourself, this is utterly and completely out of control. I was thinking that today as I was watching a little bit of Fox News. I just turned it off. And I like Fox News generally. It's the most conservative. And I kind of, you know, but as I was watching, I thought, this is insane. And Barb was there with me. She says, you really shouldn't watch this. And I said, you're right. Turn it off. She was closer to it. So she turned it off. It saved my blood pressure. She said, your blood pressure. You would think that God had nothing to do with anything by looking at it at the surface. Now, I want you to see what's going on here. Not only are these men under tremendous pressure, and they make some weird decisions, but it looks completely out of control. But it's not. It is not out of control. And the author of Scripture always wants us to view things from the Lord's perspective, which means we don't always know what's going to happen next, but we do know that above all things, God knows what he's doing. So that all is background for this. The first account, chapter 27, is David and the Philistines. Chapter 28, Saul and the psychic. Okay. David said to himself, 27:1, now I'm going to perish one of these days at the hand of Saul. 1 Samuel 27:1. I'm going to perish one of these days at the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me than to escape into the land of the Philistines. Remember the last time he did this? It was chapter 21. Did anybody remember how that went? It was right after he had started running from Saul, and he went to Achish, king of Gath, that same city he goes to here. And what did he do? He found out he was in the wrong place at the wrong time and had to feign insanity and drooled on his beard. And Achish finally said, I've got enough crazy people. Thank you very much. Get rid of this guy. And David saved his life. One would have thought that perhaps David might not go back there. But he does. So how pressed must he feel that not only is he going to go back and try and make a deal with Achish, but he's taken 1,000 people with him, men, women, and children. And furthermore, the deal he's going to make is this. I am a fierce competitor and a deadly warrior, and so are these 600 guys with me. We are more than a match for an army twice our size, and we are in very good shape. We will work for you if you'll give us a place to live. And that's a serious thing for him to say to Achish. Achish did not have a standing army. They usually did not keep standing armies, by the way. It seems like they did, and we do in our culture. But they didn't actually. What they had was a small group of soldiers. And then when they had a war, they just called a big war, sent invitations to everybody. And all the guys took whatever weapons they had, came, and they dressed up, and they went and had a war. And then when the war was over, they would go back to whatever it is they were doing before. So it wasn't like Achish had a big standing army that he could defeat. David actually had a standing army of some 600 guys right there. And they were hungry. They were lean and mean and built for speed. And they'd been out in the desert a long time. And David comes and says, or sends an envoy to Achish, and he says, I got a deal for you. Plus, Achish has heard through the years, now this has been several years, Achish figures that David probably got healed from his mental insanity and a drooling on the beard thing probably quit. And he's thinking to himself, he's heard through the news that David is really on Saul's hit list, so he feels safe enough. He doesn't want to offend this guy with 600 sharp soldiers. He'd rather have him on his side than against him, and he knows war with the Israelis is coming. Much better to have David on his side. Heavens, that's a good deal. If they're going to go to war with Saul, it would be good to have David on his side with all of his warriors. So Achish buys in to the plan. Achish is seen in the story as a little bit of a kind of a gullible guy. And David is seen as a person who is shrewd and takes advantage of the situation. Verse 2, so David arose and crossed over, he and the 600 men who were with him, to Achish the son of Maok, king of Gath. And David lived with Achish at Gath, he and his men, each with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, Abigail, remember Abigail, the Carmelitess, Nabal's widow, she's with him. Now it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, so he no longer searched for him. Besides, Saul had his other problems. He had other battles and things to fight, and he thought, well, he's gone over. And it'd be kind of weird. Saul would be thinking, what is he doing? And as the word got out, imagine David, who was once the wonder boy of Israel. Now the word gets out. He is with Gath. He's working for Achish. Oh, it's just unbelievable. But Saul figures, well, not so bad. He'll make himself an enemy among the people of Israel because they'll hear that he's gone over to the Philistines. What Saul doesn't know is that David actually has a plan for this. And so Saul stops searching for David, which is what David wanted. He wanted some peace. And you can imagine how desperately he would want it. So he does this thing. He goes over to Achish, but it doesn't stop there. David said to Achish, now, verse 5, if I found favor in your sight, let them give me a place in one of the cities in the country, that I may live there. For why should your servant be in the royal city with you? David wants to get out of the royal city. He's looking for some place in the country for his 1,000 people. Give me one of your towns. Let me take it over. I'll turn it into mine, and then I'm not underfoot here. So Achish gave him Ziklag that day. Therefore, Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. And the number of days that David lived in the country of the Philistines was 1 year and 4 months. Now, I would like you to turn and look at your maps for a minute and look how far south Ziklag is. This is an important thing. It comes into play next week. We look a little further into the story. Find a map in the back that shows you the 12 tribes, the division of the 12 tribes, or the kingdom. There's usually a map that shows you the kingdom. The kingdoms of Israel, Solomon's kingdom, David's kingdom, and Saul's. I want to point out a couple things. Ziklag is to the south. If you find the Dead Sea, go directly to from the middle of the Dead Sea, roughly, or a little below the middle of the Dead Sea. Go directly west. Sorry. To in case it was east or west, I wanted to cover my bases. Ziklag is about halfway between the Dead Sea and the Med. See it there in the south? Now, he comes all the way down from Gath, traveled due north. He takes this little town called Ziklag, and you will find Gath due north and a little bit west. So it's some distance, about 20 miles or so. Now, this is in the southern portion of Judah. Ziklag should have belonged to Judah, but they never took it under Joshua. Remember, they didn't take a lot of land, and the Lord told them that they blew it by not doing that? Ziklag is one of those places. So now, all of a sudden, Ziklag gets deeded over to the next Israelite king. Achish has no idea he's fulfilling what God always wanted for Ziklag, right? But he gives it over to David, and this is where David lives. Now, something else I want you to notice while you got your map open. You see the range of mountains? Usually you can see them on the map. Between Ziklag and the Dead Sea, there's a range of mountains that runs up the backbone of Israel. Now, travel north on those until you get up around Beth Shean. Do you see Beth Shean? It's way up there, just a little south of the Sea of Galilee and sort of close to the Jordan River there. Beth Shean's usually the last town on the Jordan River before you hit the Dead Sea. And you're going north. They've uncovered it, by the way. You can go there. If you go to Israel, Beit Shean's a great big, kind of a bustling place, and you can visit the tell, the original tell, the mound that was once the original Beit Shean. Now, it doesn't show it on some maps, but a little bit west and a little bit south of Beit Shean, you'll notice that the mountains sort of die out. Well, those mountains die out right at a rather steep incline called Mount Gilboa. And from Mount Gilboa, you can look north and you can see the Jezreel Valley. That's the valley directly north of this area. This is also known, by the way, as the Valley of Armageddon. This is the same valley. What we're going to find is that the Philistines will camp up north at Shunem on the other side of the Jezreel Valley, and Saul and his sons and the armies of Israel will be camped to the south, and Saul will be watching the battle from Mount Gilboa. That'll be in the second section. So look how this, what we're reading about tonight, covers really quite a bit from the north to the south of Israel. All right, let's go back and have a look at what happens. So Achish, what happens is that Achish says, well, you can have Ziklag. David says, thank you very much. And he takes all his people down to Ziklag. But David has no intention of really being loyal to Achish. He and his men went up, verse 8, and they raided the Geshurites, the Gerzites, and the Amalekites, for they were the inhabitants of the land from ancient times, as you come to Shur, even as far as the land of Egypt. These were longtime enemies of Israel, all of these people. They were the original inhabitants that should have been driven out by the Israelis, and they never were. So what happens is, basically, David continues the war that Joshua didn't quite finish, and that the generations since Joshua never really finished. But Achish doesn't know this. Achish is 20 miles away. They don't have, you know, cell phones. He doesn't have a satellite that takes a picture of where David is making war. He knows that David is a warlord. He knows that David is a mercenary, but he thinks he's working for him. Achish thinks that David is down fighting the enemies of the Philistines and raiding the Israelis. In reality, what David is doing is he's raiding the enemies of Israel. And furthermore, we'll find out later, he's taking some of the plunder, in fact, a lot of the plunder, and he's distributing it to the people of Israel in the south. So he's actually making a lot of friends down there. And this comes into play later when they declare him king in Hebron, 7 years before northern Israel does. But at this point, David is down in Ziklag, and he's playing a very dangerous game. This thing could not have gone on for very long. So he's raiding and destroying entire cities. He's declaring holy war on them, destroying everybody in all these cities, taking all the plunder. And then he would go back and tell Achish, well, yeah, I've been fighting the Israelis. But he's not fighting the Israelis. He's fighting the enemies of Israel. And that's what he says in verses. He left no one alive so that they couldn't go back and tell. That's what it says in verses 8 and 9. Verse 10 says, now Achish said, well, where have you made a raid today? And David said, against the Negev, that means the south of Judah, and against the south of the Jerahmeelites, and against the Negev of the Kenites. In other words, these are all people that, when Achish hears this, he says, oh, great, man. They really must hate David now. These are the Israeli places. Verse 11, David did not leave a man or a woman alive to bring to Gath, didn't take any prisoners, lest they should tell about us, saying, so has David done, and so has been his practice all the time that he's lived in the country of the Philistines. So Achish believed David, saying, he has surely made himself odious among his people Israel. Therefore, he will be my servant forever. Now, go on down to verse 2 of the next chapter. It came about in those days, the Philistines gathered their armed camps for war to fight against Israel. And Achish said to David, now know assuredly that you're going to go with me in the camp, you and your men. You guys are going to be on my side. You're going to be fighting on our side on this thing. And he thinks he's doing David a big favor. And David is, can you see David looking at him and thinking to himself, what in the world have I gotten into? And so David answers with classic political correctness. David said to Achish, very well, then you'll know what your servant can do. Which doesn't exactly explain what David plans to do, does it? The Lord's going to get him out of this. But David basically answers and says, yeah, well, when that battle happens, you'll really see what I can do. So Achish said to David, very well, I'll make you my bodyguard for life. Okay, question about all of this that I think we need to ask and point out a couple of things. Do you think David did the right thing here? There's a big debate about this. You know, you read this. Did he do the right thing? Notable by its absence is David asking the Lord if he should do this. Did you notice that? On the other hand, and he does deceive Achish, by the way, and he does declare holy war, but on the other hand, deceiving a Philistine general and making war on the enemies of Israel is sort of the job description of the king of Israel, isn't it? So maybe it wasn't such a bad decision. And don't let the lying bother you. It didn't bother them. Okay? Here's why. They felt that if they were at war, lying to the enemy was actually just part of the war. And by the way, we feel exactly the same way, do we not? That is why we have spies. That is why people lie to each other when they're in a war. I mean, did you watch Iraqi TV with the guy from Iraq? You talk about lying. This guy just needs a major award. He should have gotten, they should have an award ceremony for some of the news commentators. So that's what the lying thing is about. The question is, why did he not come to the Lord and ask him if he should do this thing? There's another thing, too, that you need to know that you don't know from here. But in 1 Chronicles chapter 12, it says something very interesting. In fact, go ahead and turn there. 1 Chronicles 12. It's just over a little further on in your Old Testament. 1 Chronicles chapter 12. There's a little added insight that we don't get from 1 Samuel. By the way, the Samuel and Chronicles stories overlap quite a bit. And you get a little added insight when you read both together on some of these accounts. Chapter 12 of 1 Chronicles says, verse 1, these are the ones who came to David at Ziklag. Wait a minute, you mean people joined David at Ziklag? Yes, defectors from Israel came to be with David, mighty warriors. They came to David at Ziklag while he was still restricted because of Saul. This was written, of course, after the fact. Restricted because of Saul, the son of Kish, and they were among the mighty men who helped him in the war. And they were equipped with bows, using both the right hand and the left to sling stones. That means they were as good at it as slinging a stone, which is like marksmanship, with the right or the left. They were ambidextrous with regard to their weaponry. That's an amazing thing. I mean, that is an amazing thing. When I sling a stone, I am as good with my right as I am with my left. But I don't think that's what they mean. I'm liable to knock myself out. These were the sons of Benjamin. Now, what tribe was Saul from? Benjamin. What does it tell you that these men defected from Saul's own people? Some of the mightiest warriors that should have been tribally, should have been on Saul's side. They're defecting while David is at Ziklag, which means politically things are shifting pretty seriously in Israel during this period of time. Now, what this would translate for David, what this would translate in his mind was maybe the Lord's doing something here. He would not have gotten the impression at this point that perhaps he had made a huge mistake going to Philistia. He lists all these guys. That's an interesting chapter. David had the most dangerous men around him, and we'll get into a little more of that as time goes by. Very fascinating men. Let's go back to 1 Samuel. So all this is happening during this period of time. Did David make a mistake by going here? Well, possibly. Possibly. Even though, and you must notice this, he was not technically in violation of his covenant with the Lord. He was not technically in violation of anything God told him. God never said, maybe it just never occurred to him. No, that's not true. It did. The Lord knows. But he never said, you can't go over to the Philistines. He never said, you can't lie to a Philistine general. He never said, you're not supposed to wipe out the other Canaanites of the land. Matter of fact, that's kind of part of the job description of a king of Israel. So David was not in violation of his covenant. But it does appear that he gets himself in a bit of a pinch when the Philistines want to take him into the battle against the Israelis. And you got to wonder what David would have done if he'd have gotten into that battle. As it turns out, he doesn't have to. And we'll see that next week if you know the story. But you got to wonder if David's thinking to himself, you know, I think I'm pretty smart and I've got myself going here, but this is a very dangerous game. I wonder if it was so wise to come over here. Might have been a mistake. Might have been a mistake. We're just not sure. But I will point out, and we'll look a little more at it in a minute, but I will point out, the Lord actually does not rebuke him, at least not in the text. The author of this does not tell us that David blew it. We are left to wonder about it. And I want you to notice something else. God does honor David. He still takes care of him. Do you ever wonder sometimes if you're going to make a mistake while trying to do your best under the circumstances and find out later that the Lord wouldn't honor you even though you were doing your very best under the circumstances? One of the reasons I like this story so much is that God honored David, even though this was perhaps less than a perfect decision, for reasons we'll talk about as we move along. But I would have been asking myself, if I was David, especially after the thing was over, I would have asked myself, I think, I wonder if I'd have waited another year in the wilderness. Maybe I'd have stayed out of some trouble. And if you've read ahead, maybe I would have had to not fight the Amalekites as badly as I did. Maybe I wouldn't have lost my wives and had to go rescue them with a major campaign. That's all in the stories ahead, so read ahead. David might have asked himself, you know, if I'd have waited another year and a half, this thing might have been a done deal. But who knows? And sometimes you just have to make the decision, trust that the Lord will use it, and press on. And that's what David does. Now we shift, the scene shifts to Saul in his major crisis. Samuel was dead, verse 3, and all Israel, chapter 28, and all Israel had lamented him and buried him in Ramah in his own city. And Saul had removed from the land those who were mediums and spiritists. Very clear in the Torah, in the Old Testament, that spiritism was illegal. God condemned it, and a spiritist was to be killed. It was death penalty. And so Saul had, probably on Samuel's instructions, cleansed the land of all the spiritists, or so he had thought. So the Philistines gathered together, and they camped at Shunem. Remember, we looked at it on the maps up north. They camped at Shunem. They were going to have a big battle in the Jezreel Valley. And Saul gathered all Israel together, and they camped at Gilboa on the south side of the valley. And when Saul saw the camp of the Philistines, he was afraid and his heart trembled greatly. Well, you see, he could actually see it. If you climb up there from Gilboa, you can look across the Jezreel Valley, and if there's a big army out there, you can see them. They raise a bunch of dust. And he would see exactly how big it was, and he would realize this is very, very dangerous. Plus, some of his very best generals and his most powerful warriors had defected to David. People had been defecting. So here's Saul, and he's stuck. And we all know that Saul liked nothing better than to win a war. And he was very concerned for his own life and reputation. And so he's very worried. When he saw the camp of the Philistines, he was afraid, verse 5, and his heart trembled greatly, and Saul inquired of the Lord. And the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by Urim or by the prophets. He inquired of the Lord. It's an odd thing. Remember, not that long ago, Saul had killed all of the priests? You got to wonder. He killed an entire village of priests, 80 families. You got to wonder how he inquired of the Lord. Because the last living one went over to David. The last living priest of that tribe went over to David and took with him the ephod. So maybe Saul made another one, or they had a spare ephod, you know, or. And the Urim refers to the Urim and the Thummim, which is the way that the priests could find out a yes or no answer from God, and or by the prophets. I think that Saul has a lot of chutzpah, that he's coming back and asking God questions after God had told him over and over and over, you're fired, hello, you're fired, you're fired, I've hired another guy. And Saul even knew who it was. He knew David was supposed to be the king. And still, he comes into this war, and he says, well, I'll just go ask God. Why? Well, the Lord doesn't answer him, and that should be an answer. That's an answer of its own, in a way, but Saul is a little thick about this sort of thing. Verse 7, and Saul said to his servants, go find me a woman who's a medium. Go find me a spiritist. I need to talk to a psychic. Actually, the particular type of medium he wanted was a necromancer. A necromancer is a person who talks to dead people. He says that I may go to her and inquire of her. Now, the question in their minds would be, why would he want to talk to a medium? And they don't find out right away. He says, I'm going to go talk to a medium. What he has in his mind is he's going to use the medium to try to talk to Samuel. And it's a very interesting thing about Saul and Samuel, because Saul felt free to disobey Samuel kind of whenever he wanted. But when the chips were down, he'd go to Samuel for advice because he knew Samuel could give him a straight answer about the future. Saul's use of spiritual things was really about Saul. Please take note of that. So anyway, he says, go find me a medium. His servant said, well, there's a woman who's a medium at Endor. Endor's across the valley. In order to get there, he has to disguise himself as a normal citizen. Of course, they didn't have photographs or anything, so this wasn't all that hard to do. Just take off his royal robes, put on the robes of a commoner, and kind of walk across and go past the guards where the Philistines were, across the Philistine area where they had taken control, and up to Endor, where there was a... But did you notice how quick they had an answer? Wait a minute, I thought all these people were supposed to be out of Israel. Does anybody know where I can find a witch? Yeah, there's one up in Endor. I've heard. And it's an interesting thing. You can say, well, such and so and such and so is not the right thing to do, and we just don't do that. But how easy it is when you make up your mind you want to find some way to sin. Sin's always available. Disobedience is always available. Right, standing right there saying, I'm right here, in case you want to disobey God. Doesn't matter how secure you think you are. Sin is right around the corner. And easily available if you change your mind and you decide you want to go find some. It's there. So anyway, they find her. Incidentally, anybody remember Bewitched, the movie? Do you remember her mom? Endora. And that's where she gets her name. That's why they named her Endora, is because of the witch at Endor. Verse 8. And Saul disguised himself by putting on other clothes, and he went, he and two of his men, and they came to the woman by night. And he said, conjure up for me, please, and bring up for me whom I shall name to you. Can you do this? I want you to do this. The woman said, hey, wait a minute, it's illegal. This is an illegal thing you're asking me to do here. So she's putting on the show. And in case this is a trap, you know, she says, Saul has cut off all those who are mediums. So she doesn't recognize him, obviously. People didn't always know who other these famous people looked like. They didn't see them on TV or anything. And all the mediums and spiritists of the land, they've been thrown out. Verse 9, why are you then laying a snare for my life to bring about my death? You know, you could be a spy for Saul. She had no idea who she's really talking to. And can you see what his bodyguards are thinking? His bodyguards kind of look at each other. You know, what if you went and told Saul about this? And Saul's standing right there. And Saul vowed to her. He said, as the Lord lives. Now, here's the disobedient king of Israel who has taken off his royal robes, has snuck across the enemy border up to a town to enlist the services of a woman whose occupation is so illegal she should be stoned. And he's going to acquire spiritistic knowledge against God's will by trying to call up Samuel. And how does he make his point? By invoking the name of the Lord. You see, in a culture that sort of takes God for granted, isn't it odd how you can do such completely horrible things and then invoke the name of the Lord in order to get your point across? Happens all the time. He says, as the Lord lives, there shall no punishment come upon you for this thing. As the Lord, what he's saying is, as the Lord lives, I have decided to disobey the Lord. And so I'm promising you that as the Lord lives, this mutual disobedience that we have is not going to cause any problem. Utter, complete, idolatrous, blasphemous disobedience to God. 11, and the woman said, okay, Who do you want me to get for you? He said, bring up Samuel for me. Now she's thinking, oh my goodness. And this is something of a seance. What happens is the woman calls up, the way they did it apparently, was the woman called up Samuel. She talked to Samuel, but Saul couldn't see him, at least not at first. She saw him, the psychic saw him. But Saul couldn't see him right away. Verse 12, and the woman saw Samuel, and she cried out. When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice. It actually is quite intense. She screamed, apparently. And the woman spoke to Saul and said, you've deceived me. You are Saul. Now, all of this crashed in on her. How she did this, we don't know. Maybe she went into a trance. Maybe she gazed into a crystal ball. Who knows? But she realized that this was happening. And she immediately realized she was scared, and she screamed when she saw Samuel. And then she realized that she was talking to Saul, because Saul's the only person who would really want to call Samuel back. I mean, she just put two and two together as she's looking at this whole thing. And he said, don't be afraid. What do you see? And the woman said to Saul, I see a divine being. Actually, it's the word for God, but they use that term sometimes in other ways. A divine being coming up out of the earth. And he said to her, what does he look like? And she said, he's an old man, and he's wrapped in a robe. And Saul knew it must be Samuel. And he bowed with his face to the ground and did homage. So here's Saul, and he's a tall, big guy. And he lays down on the ground, stretches out on the ground to lay down. Now, whether Samuel now appeared to him, or whether Samuel spoke directly through the woman, or how this happened, we're not exactly sure. But what happens is that there's a conversation between Samuel and Saul. And Samuel says to Saul, verse 15, why have you disturbed me by bringing me up? And Saul answered, well, because I'm really worried. Now, the woman might be thinking, you think you're worried. Do you remember what Samuel did to Agag, the king of the Amalekites, when you didn't kill him? I mean, Samuel was a dangerous guy. And so here's Saul violating the law of the Lord, insulting the prophet of the Lord, saying that he's actually not good, has no intention of obeying God, violating all the rules, calling up Samuel. And the woman's thinking to herself, I don't even want to be here. And Samuel is upset, which is common. I mean, almost every time he talked to Saul in those later years, he was upset at him. And Saul answered, well, I'm really distressed because, look, like the Philistines are waging war against me, and God has departed from me and answers me no more, either through the prophets or by dreams. Interesting how much experience Saul had, by the way, in spiritual communication from God. He was actually relatively accustomed to talking to a live prophet or receiving a prophecy himself or having a dream in which God spoke to him. And it's an interesting thing how many people think that if that were to happen to them, their faith would grow mightily, and that they would be a very strong believer if they only could have a few of those kinds of experiences. That would certainly be, that would help them to be obedient to God. It's interesting that Saul had more of that than David, and Saul was profoundly disobedient to God. One of the recurring themes in the scriptures is that God does speak to his people. But along with that is the fact that when he does, it does not ensure that his people are going to listen or that they will be any more obedient for having had a vision or a voice or having spoken to a prophet. It's just an interesting thing. So anyway, he says, look, I'm talking to you because God won't talk to me. Huh, go figure. And so I wanted you to tell me what I should do. Isn't this an amazing question? I mean, Samuel had been telling Saul what to do for so long, and now here's Saul, what shall I do? And Samuel said, what? Verse 6, I was having fun down there, and you called me back here? Why then do you ask me, since the Lord has departed from me, become your adversary? And the Lord has done according as he spoke through me. Don't you remember what I told you? The Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand, given it to your neighbor, to David. See, Saul knew David was supposed to be the next king. As you did not obey the Lord and did not execute his fierce wrath on Amalek, the Lord has done this thing to you today. And furthermore, verse 19, and you can just, I mean, I always think of people standing around. What are the two guards, you know, and the spiritist woman? What are they thinking as they're watching this? Just an amazing thing. And Samuel goes on, "Moreover, the Lord also will give over Israel along with you into the hands of the Philistines." You're going to lose this one. "Therefore, tomorrow you and your sons will be with me." "Indeed, the Lord will give over the army of Israel to the hands of the Philistines." Whoa. Can you imagine hearing that? "By this time tomorrow." It's like the guy who had a vision and discovered to his great joy that there was baseball in heaven and then found out he was pitching the following week. That's exactly what happens here. Saul is going, "Well, tell me what's going to happen." And Samuel says, "Well, I'll tell you what's going to happen. What's going to happen is you're going to die. You and your sons are going to be dead. You're going to be with me." Now, whether he means with me in the good side of paradise or with me just saying you'll be dead, we don't know. We don't know. But Saul was terribly frightened. And in fact, he stretched out on the floor and wouldn't get up. And they tried to get him up and he wouldn't. He had been fasting for about 24 hours, so he was weak. The woman said, verse 21, "Look, I did everything you told me to do. So would you eat something here? You got to get up and go get killed. So eat something." So verse 23, he refused. He says, "No, I'm not going to eat." And his servants and the woman urged him, and they got him up off the ground. He sat on the bed. You can just see the scene. It's like, oh, no, I can't believe it. And he gets up, and he sits on the edge of the bed, and he's just crushed. And the woman made some food, and she made him eat, and then they left. Now, it's an interesting thing. It's a very important picture of Saul. Here's a man who spent his life living for himself. Called by God, mightily gifted, and yet he ends his days without his kingly robes on at this point. The judgment comes and he's not wearing his robes. He is in a state of complete disobedience to the Torah, to God's word. He is so weak he can't even get up, and a spiritist who shouldn't even be in the land is trying to force him to eat something, the king of Israel. What a completely debauched scene. And the author wants us to see that. I mean, that's the picture that we're seeing, is a man whose life was ruined by his profound self-centeredness, by the fact that he never really got caught on to what was going on. Question that always comes up is, of course, did she really call Samuel up? I mean, you know, that's a big question everybody has, and they come back to this thing. And of course, there's a bazillion books written all about it and all that stuff. We don't know if she really called Samuel up or if this was just a vision or what all happened. And nobody knows if she herself was able to. In fact, I am of the opinion that she wasn't always able to do this sort of thing, and that's why she screamed when she realized Samuel was really there. I really think that it shocked her and surprised her. And she knew that it was illegal to do what she was doing, and she was calling back the guy who killed people for doing this. I mean, think about this. So she's freaked, you know. And God is sovereign. He can bring this about. In the text, the indicator is Samuel is actually there. Whether he was or not, there's no question what the text means. The issue is that Saul was rebuked and that he was in violation of the word of God completely. And that the Lord said, listen, if you're not going to obey what I've already told you, what makes you think you're going to get any more? Which is a really great question. If you're living in open, flagrant, long-time disobedience to God, and you then say, well, Lord, tell me what to do, you're not really asking the right question at all. So all of that is very clear in the fact that Saul is being rebuked. So whether or not this was the real Samuel, I tend to think it was. And that the Lord simply broke the rules this one time in order to rebuke Saul. Because Jesus said, people don't come back and forth. And contacting spirits is a very dangerous thing. Incidentally, it was not outlawed in Israel. Magic wasn't outlawed in Israel because it was fakery. It was outlawed in Israel because it was idolatry. It was trying to find spiritual truth without going to God. And that's actually idolatry. It was, we tend to think it's all fakery, and a lot of it is, but there is a real spiritism, and it was outlawed because it is a form of idolatry. You want ultimate truth, you go to God. You listen to what he says, and you do what he says. If you go around, you do an end run around God, it carried the death penalty. If you tried to manipulate spiritual forces outside of the work of God himself and without a covenant with God, that was a very deadly thing. That's why it was outlawed. So whether or not she brought him up, I don't know. But I do believe the Lord at least did. I think the Lord actually let this happen. Couple of things, two observations. Notice, and they're kind of odd. Remember I told you these men made decisions and so on? David did not inquire of the Lord before he made his decision. On the other hand, in his heart, he wanted to serve God. You can tell by what he does. He never breaks covenant with God. He breaks covenant with Achish, but he could make a pretty good case for doing that. Achish was an enemy. But he never breaks covenant with God. David did not inquire of the Lord, but on the other hand, he really wanted to obey him ultimately. In his heart, his intent was long-term obedience. On the other hand, now notice that Saul did inquire of the Lord. Did you notice that? Saul actually tries desperately to find out what God wants. But in his heart, he had no intention of obeying God unless he really wanted to, and he thought it was in his best interest. So on the surface, it looks like David is a traitor walking away, and Saul is a godly man. And if you didn't know the facts, if you didn't know behind the scenes, you'd say, well, why is the Lord not talking to Saul? He's the king of Israel, and he's crying out, weeping, pouring his heart out to God, and God's being quiet. Why? We'll see. Well, we know the story. But the fact of the matter is, you don't always see things on the surface, do you? And the surface doesn't always tell the story. When you look at people's lives and you see certain things taking place, we really don't know what God is doing in people's lives. Sometimes people look a lot worse than they really are, and sometimes people look a lot better than they really are. And it's odd to look at both of these two men. Outward appearances really don't tell the story. Well, what about the issue of guidance? Let me close with just a couple things. Some questions that you can ask. Three questions that help us determine the Lord's guidance. Because when the pressure's on, you really do want to know. Lord, what shall I do? What direction should I go? I can't tell you point blank. And I don't recommend that you go try to find a spiritist to tell you what you ought to do. But I can have you ask three questions, and perhaps by asking these questions, some clarity will come with decision making. Number one, ask yourself this: what is my spiritual default setting? In other words, when things go bad, where do I turn? Now, in David's case, when things went bad, David always turned to God. And even in the case where he made perhaps a mistaken decision, he never broke covenant with God. In Saul's case, he would appear to be godly, but whenever anything really went south, he would scramble and do anything. He would disobey God in any way in order to get his way. Because his view of God was, God's here to serve me. So ask yourself this question: what is my spiritual default setting? If my computer gets unplugged and then plugged back in again, what are the setting? What are the settings? Am I Christian? Do I trust God? When stuff goes south in my life, do I claw my way back, if I have to, into the Lord's presence, weeping and repenting and saying, Lord, I have blown it. It's my fault. Just let me be a doorkeeper in your house. Or do you say, well, you know, I'm going to have to get God on my side about this thing because I'm not going to win if I don't have God on my side. There's a world of difference between those two. That's a good question to ask. What is my default setting, spiritually speaking? That will help you make decisions. I promise you it will. Because sometimes we try to make decisions without asking ourselves who we're really serving. Here's another question. Is fear motivating any of my decisions right now? The tendency always for fear is to force us to do something disobedient. When we make decisions out of sheer fear, the chances of making a bad decision are pretty high. Now, I don't mean simply the presence of fear. I mean when fear is the driver. And when fear tells you, you know what, I know this isn't God's will, but if you don't do it, look what's going to happen. And that's a fear-driven decision. If you're making decisions, ask yourself, how much of my decision-making is being prompted by just plain fear, in which, if I were to translate it around and say, I'm going to trust God with this, I would actually have a fairly clear decision in front of me. But I'm afraid of whatever, you know, fill in the blank. I'm afraid of the health risks, or I'm afraid of the financial risks, or I'm afraid of that the business might go, or I'm afraid of the friends that might not understand, or whatever. Fill it in. Whatever's the threat, see? If it's fear, then chances are, if you make it just based on fear, chances are pretty high that you're liable to make a decision that at least you might want to remake later. Now, I think David, if David made a mistake, it was based on fear. Whether he made one or not, we can debate that. But if he did make one, if going over to Gath was a mistake, it was a mistake based in fear. So ask yourself that decision. Is fear motivating any of my decisions right now? And if I were to take the fear out of it, what would the decision be? If I really weren't afraid of anything, what would I do? If I really pretended that I could trust God about everything that's going on here, what would I do? And here's the third thing. Is my heart totally committed to God's revealed plans? In other words, what I know he's doing in the earth, am I committed to those things? This is a recurring theme in the scriptures, and it's something we need to clarify. When you're seeking God's will, very often it's something along the lines of, should I do this? And it's a detail that if it goes bad, we're going to feel bad or lose things or whatever. And actually what the Lord is a little bit more concerned about with what he's doing on earth than what we're doing on. He's not just like going around and saying, well, you know what? I was planning for your retirement, but look what's going to go wrong here. And you know, if I had time, I'd work in the Middle East, but I am worried about your situation here. It's not like that. He does care about our situations, but we care about some things a whole lot more in which he might say, well, you know, I'm actually have a plan going on in the world, and I'm fairly busy with it. And furthermore, I've called you to be a part of it. If you put this decision in light of my overall plan, would it change the decision? Or would the decision be pre-made for you? Or at least the direction you feel you need to pursue? In other words, it's not so much, can I get guidance from God about what to do about this detail in my life to make my life better? It's more along the lines of, Lord, you're doing some very important things. You've revealed in your word, and I'm called into those higher and more important things. How does my decision fit into that? If I go this direction in this decision, how will it affect that long-term thing that I know you're doing? If I go this other direction, how will that affect your business? Well, how does it affect the family business if I do this or that or the other thing? Now, sometimes it'll affect the family business in such a way that we just have to say, well, then I can't do what I wanted to do for me. Because the family business is more important. God's overall plan, what his revealed will is more important. And that, a lot of times, makes some of these smaller decisions where we get all kind of hung up on a small decision and worried about it, and so we fret over it a lot. But you back off and you say, well, wait a minute. If I make this decision according to his priorities and his plan, actually, it helps me make it. But I don't get what I want always. That's just kind of the way it goes. A thing to remember about this is that God's will really is more about your heart than it is about your activities. People say, well, where does he want me geographically? That's a secondary issue. I think David was more in God's will living in Ziklag than Saul was living in up in the hills of Israel because of where their heart was. And we're worried about the geography, the activities, and so on. He says, no, get your heart in line with what I'm doing in the world and then make your decisions based on what you think is going to really promote, in our case, the gospel and the life of the Spirit in the gospel. So that helps sometimes. It probably doesn't solve all your problems. But maybe it'll bring a little perspective. The fact is, whatever you're facing is real big, I'm sure, and probably quite demanding. And I know that the Lord will use any person who says, my fate is in your hands. You do what you want through me in my life, and I will put everything I can on the line. That person, no matter what happens, does not have to worry about one particular thing, and that is whether or not they'll be in God's will. They may worry about some other things that they would like to see happen. But that one thing, whether or not they're in God's will, that they will not have to worry about. Because if you want to be in God's will and he wants you to be in his will, you are not going to miss it by accident. David was in God's will because of who he was in his heart. And even when he made what might have been a mistake, the Lord still honored him. Saul, the exact opposite. We'll see a little more about that next time. Let's bow our heads. So take a moment and think about the decisions you're making right now and things that are facing you. Perhaps the Lord spoke to you in this Bible study tonight, and you don't need to tell anybody else about it. If you'd like some prayer, Pastor Don's back there. He'll be in the prayer room, and we would love to pray for you. But perhaps you would just like to say to the Lord, Lord, would you continue to speak what you spoke to me tonight, and let me make these decisions based on the default setting of faith. I want that to be where my heart is. And perhaps those decisions will come more clear to you. Father, thank you that the challenges in our lives are the right size for who we are. We always think other people's challenges would be easier for us to handle, but we have our own, and these seem to really test our faith. As we look at David and the size of his challenges, I would not want his. But Lord, we pray that we would learn how to have a heart after you, that even if we make a well-intentioned mistake, we might trust that you will still be with us. And help us to learn from Saul, not to just act like we believe you, but to really be there. We trust you, Lord, to speak these things to our souls and to go before us in all the decisions we make. In Jesus' name, amen.
That marks the end of this study in God's Word. If you have further questions about this study, or you would like to know more about a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, please contact us. Our phone number is area code 541-878-3501. You can call us Monday through Friday during regular business hours. If you prefer email, the address is pastors@trail.org. That's pastors@trail.org. This recording is a production of Willing Heart Ministries, dedicated to expanding the teaching ministry of Trail Christian Fellowship into all the world.